It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Pennsylvania House returns to session September 17th, the Senate the following week. What are the priorities for legislative leaders? Republican Representative Brian Cutler of Lancaster County is the House Majority Leader. Welcome to The Confluence, sir.
All right. Thank you, Kevin.
So what tops your list when you and your colleagues return to Harrisburg?
Well, we obviously had a very busy spring. We had one of the busiest legislative starts in the last 30 years, and we covered a wide variety of important topics up through and including the end of the budget. Obviously, the budget was probably the paramount concern for many individuals. While we were able to accomplish all of that prior to the end of June, there were still several issues that were undone or uncompleted, and I think they'll be at the top of the list when we return here in the fall. Mm-hmm. First and foremost would be some of the election reforms. There was a disagreement with the governor over straight party voting and the elimination of that. I personally think that's an antiquated practice, and we should take a look at it.
Why is that the case that you think it should be removed?
The fastest growing voter demographic is not Republican or Democrat. It's independent or third party voters. And in an effort to be inclusive, I think that we need to make sure that people are electing candidates and not just parties.
Election reform, what would you like to see done, whether it's regarding absentee voting or same day registration or what have you?
Well, the first one actually I think is both. It's something that I personally would like to see done as well as what I think the votes are there for, because we already passed it once, and that is changing all of the dates. The timelines are very difficult. In some cases, you could send the ballots out a day or two before they're supposed to be returned. So you're really, I think, unfairly burdening individuals who have requested an absentee ballot to most likely have to deliver them in person. And the whole idea of getting an absentee ballot is so that you can still vote, but not be inconvenienced on election day or the day or two before. I think a lot of the other issues can certainly be discussed. When you look at some of the voting requirements, I think they're unfair for third-party candidates to have access to the ballot. The signature requirements, I think that we could take a look at those areas where we circulate our petitions early in the year. We need a set number of signatures. I think that we could look for changes like that to make things more consistent as well.
House Majority Leader Brian Cutler is our guest on The Confluence. Earlier this year, the governor unveiled a $4.5 billion infrastructure plan targeting everything from transportation to internet access to flood control to brownfield cleanup. You recently announced a task force to study infrastructure needs. What specifically do you want to know?
Well, regarding the infrastructure, there's a couple big financial cliffs that we're approaching. One is the turnpike bonding, and that money goes into the transportation system for mass transit and projects. So that is something that is coming due very soon, about $450 million every year. That has contributed significantly to the turnpike debt burden. I think also one of the things that we can do as a Commonwealth is we need to have a much longer term vision, get outside, every 2 or 4 year election cycle and look down 10, 15, 20 years. What are the infrastructure projects that are needed in order to maintain our competitiveness? So I think that we've made a good step with Act 89 several years ago, which was the transportation infrastructure investment with the increase of the gas tax and several billion dollars in catch-up money coming in to catch us up on deficient bridges and road projects and things like that. But we need to stay on top of our game as we go forward and make sure that we're looking to the future as well. Regarding some of the infrastructure development that the governor wants to do, I think this issue is like many of the other ones that we have here in Harrisburg, and that is this, that we oftentimes agree on the underlying problem. Where we disagree is on how best to fix it.
Fixing it, you mean how to fund it as well, because the governor has proposed a severance tax on shale gas. How would you pay for any investments in infrastructure that you and your colleagues would like to do in Pennsylvania?
I think you nailed it right there in regards to what the disagreement is over. And I'll go one layer lower, not just some of the concerns regarding the severance tax, but the large amount of borrowing that is associated with that of $4.5 billion. That's a substantial increase in funds to borrow. And one of the things that we're trying to do, and we did it this cycle as well in the budget as in prior cycles, we're trying to live like many of the people in the Commonwealth, and that is live within our means. We had a very robust economy this time, and we were able to put a substantial amount of money for the second year in a row. When you can make those kinds of investments in our rainy day fund and then continue to hopefully have a very robust economy heading into this budget year, I think we can start to look at longer term vision casting again, to look at our infrastructure, look at our flooding concerns and other targeted areas so that we can pay as we go, as opposed to borrowing years into the future.
So I understand it, no borrowing, but no dedicated funding stream per se.
No, it's not that we couldn't have a discussion about a dedicated funding stream or redirecting existing funding streams that we already have. And I think that that's one of the things that we have to look at. And there's really no reason why you couldn't take an existing revenue stream and dedicate it to areas of improvement, whatever they may be.
Senate Democratic Leader Jay Costa was on the Confluence recently. He says he's hoping the legislature will take another look at raising the minimum wage, which is $7.25 an hour. A proposal by Governor Wolf to boost the minimum up to $12 an hour went nowhere this spring. The senator said that maybe they were just asking for too much over too short of a period. So might you revisit this issue?
Well, that's like many of the policy issues that we've discussed so far, and I'm sure we'll continue to discuss well into the fall. And that is, again, there's a slight disagreement on how to best solve the situation. I think we should be far more focused on getting individuals into those higher paying jobs that pay far more than minimum wage, which is why we put a lot of the money into those areas regarding career and technical development, workforce development, because if we can have people earning more than minimum wage, that really should be our goal, not arbitrarily picking a number as government to be minimum wage. One of the areas for wages I think that we should visit is the tax forgiveness number that's currently been stagnant in law for years. I think instead of asking businesses to artificially raise the wages, we should just ask government to take less. And I think that that is something that I'd like to discuss further, because if you can increase that allowance for tax forgiveness, I think that that gives more people an opportunity to keep more of their checks. And that's really what the goal is, I think.
State Representative, it's been nearly a year since the release of the grand jury report on abuse of children by Catholic priests. That report led to a renewed call to eliminate the statute of limitations for future victims and establish a 2-year window for victims whose time had expired to file suit. Do you support that proposal? Will it get anywhere?
Well, we've already passed those two bills out of the House. We actually bifurcated the bill. We did both a constitutional amendment as well as a statutory change. So those bills are currently in the Senate.
Do you think your colleagues in the other chamber in the Senate will follow the House's lead on this?
That I'm not certain of. We'll have to wait and see what the bills look like if and when they come out of committee, what the amendments are. If they are amended, they would come back to the House. But my personal hope is, because I think this issue has been out there for too long, the one thing that we do know is that going forward, let's suppose that the court says a retroactive window is unconstitutional, which is possible under existing case law. If they say that, that means that we have some number of victims greater than zero over the last 6 or 7 years that have now been precluded from getting any remedy to their problem, which is why we decided to split the issues and move them as independent bills, both as a constitutional amendment and a statutory change, because we thought that had the best possibility for success and hopefully agreement. But we have to fix it prospectively, in my opinion, immediately, because if the courts come and rule the retroactivity to be unconstitutional, you've got some number of victims who have already aged out, and that's unacceptable.
Earlier, you mentioned your priorities. What realistically do you expect to get passed before the end of this calendar year?
I think some of it's going to be cleanup based on what wasn't done in the spring, you know, some of the election reforms. Criminal justice reform, I think, will be a high priority when we come back. And I think it's something that we need to continue. I think we need to be smart on how we deal with being tough on crime. And I think that's all part of it. And I think that you'll see a continuation of some healthcare related issues. We passed the insurance exchange, myself and Leader Dermody worked on that bill. I think you're going to see continued issues and solutions regarding rural health access. And I would like to get some of the Pension Commission recommendations done because I think that that would also improve the financial stability of our state.
Republican Representative Brian Cutler from Lancaster County is the House Majority Leader. Thanks for taking the time today.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. We go from the Pennsylvania House to the U.S. Senate. In the aftermath of this weekend's mass shootings in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio, both of Pennsylvania's U.S. senators have called for passage of gun control legislation. WESA Government and Accountability reporter Lucy Perkins has been covering this story. Lucy, welcome back to the Confluence.
Thanks for having me.
Republican Senator Pat Toomey wants to revive a bill that he and Democrat Joe Manchin first introduced about 6 years ago after the devastating murders of 20 children and a half dozen adults at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Connecticut. What would this legislation do?
Yeah, so that legislation that was proposed, as you said, like 6 years ago, would strengthen background checks. It would include background checks for gun sales online and at gun shows. And that was the first attempt. It's called the Manchin-Toomey Amendment. It amended another bill. And that was the first attempt to expand background checks from Senator Schumer.
Right. And obviously that failed 6 years ago.
Yeah, it did.
How big of an obstacle does Senator Toomey consider his Senate leader, Mitch McConnell, who has blocked efforts in the past?
Right. And Senator McConnell, a Republican from Kentucky, is known for kind of holding up various bills in the Senate. Toomey said yesterday, on Monday, that he spoke with McConnell before he was on this call with reporters. He said he didn't want to characterize McConnell's thoughts on gun control legislation, but he said his view is that if there's enough support in the Senate, then we ought to have a vote. But he really didn't give any clear details on what McConnell's real thoughts were.
So Toomey said we ought to have a vote if there's enough votes among his colleagues in the Senate chamber. Did he indicate that McConnell would be willing to do that if he did counted the numbers?
Yeah, he didn't say anything at all about that. He just said his own personal preference, which he's, you know, reiterated time and time again. I talked to him earlier this winter way back at the beginning of 2019 about this. And he said the exact same thing. If there's enough votes, if there's enough support, we should have a vote on it. And that's it.
Senator Toomey spoke with reporters, including yourself, on Monday after speaking with President Trump. Did the president reach out to Toomey or was it the other way around?
Yeah, so the president called Senator Toomey yesterday in the wake of these deadly attacks over the weekend. And they talked about what Toomey said were a variety of issues, including this Manchin-Toomey proposal that we've been talking about that would strengthen background checks, which the president said he was interested in.
Was it all about guns and the aftermath of the weekend? Were there any other issues? Did they come up?
I'm actually not sure if they talked about other things. Of course, that was what every reporter on this call was interested in talking about, was whether or not the president indicated strong support for these more comprehensive right. background checks or not. Yeah.
Senator Cory Booker, Democratic presidential candidate, said Sunday on CNN that the president was, quote, responsible for the El Paso shooting because of his anti-immigrant rhetoric. An online manifesto supposedly written by the shooter echoed some of the president's words in the past. Did Senator Toomey criticize the president or his choice of words?
He really didn't. He was very hesitant to criticize the president in this regard. He, when asked about it several times, he did say that it's important to assign responsibility where it belongs and that, you know, the people who are responsible for these murders over the weekend were the people who pulled the triggers. He said he didn't like the idea of going around and blaming other people, but that's really as specific as he got. He didn't mention the president by name.
Mm-hmm. Did the senator indicate whether the president would support his bill, the Manchin-Toomey bill? Did he get to that or not? Because, after all, the president reached out to the senator, as you said.
He did reach out to Toomey, but Toomey really wasn't sure whether or not the president would support this proposal. I mean, after the Parkland, Florida shooting in 2018 at the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, there was a lot of talk of gun reform measures. President Trump had survivors come to the White House, and Toomey was part of those conversations too. But, you know, when asked about it yesterday, if anything would be different, he said he wasn't sure.
Does he expect any backlash from Second Amendment rights activists, Senator Toomey?
You know, as you can imagine, he didn't really talk too much about the NRA in this call. But he, over the years, has kind of gotten less support and less favorable ratings from pro-gun groups like the NRA.
Some have called for Congress to return from summer recess to take action. Does Toomey think that's a good idea?
Right. So the Senate is currently not in Washington. Many of them are back in their districts for this August recess that happens every year. Toomey does not think it's a good idea for the Senate to come back and force a vote on this. He doesn't think Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell should call everyone back, because he said if this was voted on tomorrow, they just wouldn't have enough support, and it would probably hinder their efforts.
Lucy Perkins covers the federal government for WESA. Lucy, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence. The state set aside an unprecedented sum of money last year for schools to make safety and security upgrades. So how did local administrators choose to spend that money? The University of Pittsburgh's Department of Geology and Environmental Sciences is trying to find solutions to deal with problems like stormwater overflow and contamination. And several television stations are changing frequencies to open up airwaves for new high-speed wireless services. You can find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence on our website at wesa.fm/confluence.
Stephen Smith didn't like his name. He thought it sounded too bookish. And Steve wouldn't work either, because he felt that made him sound like a jock. After he graduated high school, Smith took on his new identity as Elliot. After college, Smith made a number of acclaimed albums with his group Heat Miser before recording on his own with encouragement from his then-girlfriend. That debut album, Roman Candle, was regarded highly by critics and fans, even though Smith thought a hushed bedroom recording would land flat in the grunge era. Elliot Smith was born 50 years ago today. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pennsylvania set aside tens of millions of dollars last year for schools to make safety and security upgrades. It was an unprecedented sum. What we didn't know was how local administrators would choose to spend that money until now. Keystone Crossroads reporter Avi Wolfman-Arendt got an exclusive look at the details.
Rockwood Area School District sits 70 miles outside Pittsburgh in remote Somerset County. Superintendent Mark Bauer says it's the kind of place where people like to keep their doors unlocked.
So we were one of the last districts in the area and probably throughout the state that would have locked our doors.
That started to change about 10 years ago. Now, instead of sauntering into the building, visitors have their IDs checked against a sexual predator database.
We've also gone from having no cameras in the district as far as surveillance cameras in or outside, to now we have over 125 cameras.
This new state money allowed Rockwood area to add yet another level of security. The district got $90,000 for a modernized intercom system. There's now a panic button secretaries can push to contact the police. And teachers can use something called status lights to instantly communicate whether their classroom is safe or in distress.
It'd be more of something like you would see in a hospital.
It's been over a year since a gunman murdered 17 people at Parkland High School in Florida. That shooting unleashed a wave of debate and protest about gun reform.
We can and we will change the world.
The Parkland shooting also refocused attention on the best way to secure school buildings. There's been significant coverage of newer strategies like arming teachers or using software to monitor students' social media. But there's also been other, quieter changes on a far bigger scale. Through a right-to-know request, Keystone Crossroads reviewed executive summaries written by the 231 districts, technical schools, and charter schools that won competitive state grants totaling $40 million. They paint a portrait of how school security has changed and will continue to change in Pennsylvania.
A lot of stuff you don't see. It's very discreet.
Gerald Whitmer Jr. runs the Redding Muhlenberg Career and Technology Center in Berks County. His school added panic buttons, a strobe light system that illuminates when the school is in lockdown, and 15 cameras to bring the school's total to 90. Even though the cameras are meant to deter the most heinous crimes, he says they make a big difference in school climate.
The students know they're being recorded. They know they're going to be accountable. They know that, you know, the story they give better match the, you know, what the video shows. And so it really has helped to maintain a peaceful environment.
Video surveillance was a common theme in the applications, along with school counselors and social workers. Other requests included school police, emergency radio technology, electronic locks, even license plate readers, and yoga classes.
Some of the things contained in here hurt but don't help, and other things are really good ideas.
Chad Marlowe is with the American Civil Liberties Union. He likes the focus on mental health services, but not the uptick in video cameras.
That's almost Orwellian-level surveillance. I'm not suggesting that, like, the schools of Pennsylvania are going to turn into a totalitarian state, but I don't think that there's any question that surveillance has adverse impacts on people's sense of freedom and liberty, and freedom and liberty are very important in an academic environment.
Even some school administrators who see real value in surveillance technology say they wish it didn't have to be that way. Again, Mark Bauer from Rockwood Area School District.
It's really a heartbreaker to see what has changed in our society and in schools.
This spring, the district received what it considered a credible threat and went into lockdown. Parents and staff expect the school to be ready for that kind of menace.
Though at the same time, you know, it just changes the environment. I can't imagine growing up during the Cold War where you had to hide under your desk. And so I kind of liken it to that.
This time, though, the response isn't to a distant superpower, but instead a threat from within. Avi Wolfman-Arendt, Keystone Crossroads.
You can find the details of what your district purchased at WHYY.org. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. For years, even decades, officials in southwestern Pennsylvania have been trying to deal with stormwater overflow, getting into our water sources, as well as implementing green infrastructure to help find solutions. Faculty in the University of Pittsburgh's Department of Geology and Environmental Sciences founded the Pittsburgh Collaboratory for Water Research, Education, and Outreach. Two of the founders of the Collaboratory join us in studio, Emily Elliott and Dan Bain. Welcome to The Confluence. Good to have you here.
Thanks, Kevin. Good to be here.
Thank you so much.
So, Emily, let's start with you. Who's involved? Who are the stakeholders?
That's a great question. So when we started this effort, there was four faculty from the Department of Geology and Environmental Sciences that were very interested in sort of taking a broad brush approach to figuring out who are the players working in water in this region. And we constructed a map of who these water stakeholders were. And it was an enormous effort because there are so many parties involved with water, from academic researchers to municipal governments to NGOs to watershed organizations, et cetera, et cetera. And they all have their own interests and they're all somewhat acting individually. And what we were interested in doing is trying to help bridge the gap between the academic capacities at the University of Pittsburgh and beyond with some of the water challenges in our region to make collaborations easier.
Your group recently issued a white paper. What's the primary recommendation when it comes to what is being done right now and what is not known? Dan?
Right. So these white papers are a result of actually meetings where these stakeholders would come together and go through a process to come to a consensus on what the needs were. And one of the emergent needs from the Green Infrastructure White Paper is that, you know, as we implement these things, we need to be able to learn. And so one of the things we need to do is organize our data. And one of the things we probably really need to do at this juncture is build an overarching structure so that we can organize, share, and analyze that data.
Emily?
Yeah, so I think Dan raises the critical issue that was raised at this first meeting, which was we're all relying on green infrastructure to be effective in managing stormwater, but yet we are lacking the data to effectively evaluate how effective it will be, which practices work best in this region with very shallow soils, complex groundwater patterns, and steep topography.
So you've suggested a regional database. What information is it that you want included?
The database that everybody wants is the one that has everything. So it's really, yeah. When you're thinking of building this, you have to build it in steps. So I think the question might be, what would be the first thing you'd want to do to start to organize? I think cost is important. I think that some of that data is going to be a challenge to get. I think that there's also underlying just simple physical constraints, like how fast can the soil absorb water in a particular area? There's a lot of data that's been collected, but it hasn't been organized to say, this is the best place to put water in. This place really shouldn't have water put into it.
Well, how do you get regional practitioners to contribute their information to this database?
That's a great question, too. Through this process, we invited as many participants as we could to the table to be involved with the discussions, with the idea that hopefully we can incorporate as many of them as possible into the solution phase of this, which would be building the database. So we have started discussions about, you know, how would we do this next step? Which partners would be important to help make those key decisions about what data to collect first?
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. Our guests are two researchers with the University of Pittsburgh who helped found the Pittsburgh Collaboratory for Water Research, Education, and Outreach. We hear about green infrastructure and gray infrastructure. What's really the difference, Dan?
So gray infrastructure would be what we typically think of as, you know, our sewer system, our water system. It's what we started installing basically in the 1900s on. And, you know, you bury your streams, you bury your pipes underground. So you don't really see it. You don't really think about it. You have to pump water around to get it to move. It's energy intensive. It's resource intensive. Green infrastructure is really something where you try to mimic natural processes. So you use things like gravity to move your water. You put water through the soil where it slows down and it doesn't go right into your stream really quickly and contribute to downstream flooding.
It filters that
water. And it definitely has water quality improvements. You know, in this region, we tend to think much more about quantity because we're trying to keep the overflows from happening.
Emily, what are the co-benefits, if you would, from green infrastructure, aside from dealing with the overflow of stormwater?
Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of co-benefits of green infrastructure, and I think considering what these are and how valuable they are is an important part of the equation. So, for example, some of the co-benefits might be, like you mentioned, increased infiltration. So if you have water percolating through a soil or being taken up by vegetation, you can have considerable improvements in that water quality. Other co-benefits might be beautification of the landscape. You might have a public demonstration project about what you're trying to do with the water.
Are there health benefits as well? Or social benefits? You mentioned beautification.
One of the things about green infrastructure that is the hope is that it's going to increase vastly the amount of green space that, you know, because you're going to have to create infrastructure on the landscape. But if you create it such a way that, you know, the Bartlett Meadow, which is a demonstration project in Schenley Park, they changed what was a mowed lawn into something that's more of a prairie system. And that gives you benefits. It starts to break up the soil, make it more able to infiltrate that water. It slows the water down. But it's also something that, if you walk through that at night, the number of fireflies that are just blinking on and off this time of year, or maybe last month, it's not something you would normally get if we were only using the gray infrastructure.
Lights up your pathway.
Yeah.
The water challenges, I mean, they've been apparent for a while, but there hasn't been a unified approach to develop policies and answers. If you agree with that, why not?
I think that, I mean, when I was in college, the Pittsburgh region was the prime example of fractured governance. Just the way in which Pittsburgh grew and the boroughs grew around it, it's really hard to do the kinds of things you need to do with water, which is a comprehensive approach where everything works together and you think about it as one. If you've got 7 to 8 boroughs stretching across your watershed with a completely distinct set of things they want to get done. So that's sort of the things we keep running up against, which is this fractured governance.
Are we too much focused on this community, this municipality ends here, as opposed to this municipality and adjacent municipality, right, all are part instead of this watershed?
Right. Instead of this municipality is upstream of this one and this one and this one. And what happens in Ross is going to impact Millvale. Right. So, I mean, that's the scale we need to be thinking about, is how do you make land use decisions? How do you most effectively manage the large amount of stormwater runoff we have in this region, given those constraints?
We started our conversation talking about these challenges. These issues have been with us years and years and years. And yet, more recently, we've been seeing more and more rain. So do the answers need to be derived sooner rather than later?
That's a great question. I think in my lifetime, we've seen changes. In the past 5 years, we've even seen changes in this region. And in terms of the intensity of precipitation, the frequency of precipitation. And I think we can expect that to continue changing. I don't think the status quo is any longer the case for the weather in this region. And I don't think we can continue using, the 500-year or the 50-year or the flood, the floodplains as described in the past to understand what's going to happen in the future. And I think one of the broader aims of what we're trying to do is a little bit more general, and that is to elevate conversations around water. I mean, this region is blessed to be so water rich and to have these beautiful rivers running through the Free Rivers region. They just happen to have really bad water quality. And you don't see that coming up in the daily conversations of people. I don't think it's widely recognized that the water that comes out of my tap is water that's being pulled from the Allegheny River that 5 upstream communities are dumping wastewater into, right? So I think to the extent that we can garner people's interests and raise awareness about the water challenges around quality, stormwater runoff, and flooding, I think we'll have more success in motivating change and raising these issues to make the difficult decisions that need to be made to give impetus for that change.
Emily Elliott and Dan Bain are professors in Pitt's Department of Geology and Environmental Sciences, and they're among the founders of the Pittsburgh Collaboratory for Water Research, Education, and Outreach. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you so much.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Television stations in many markets will be changing how they broadcast to give more space to high-speed internet providers. It's part of a plan to go to auction by the Federal Communications Commission. Joining us to talk about how stations and viewers will be affected, as well as the sale, is Gene Cadu, chair of the FCC's Incentive Auction Task Force. Thanks for making the time.
Thank you, Kevin. Thanks for having me.
Jane, let's jump right into the weeds. This has to do with frequency, broadcast frequency. It's how a signal gets to the consumer. So these frequencies that might be up for grabs, they're in the middle range. How are they being used now?
Well, what this particular auction was all about is that we incentivized broadcasters nationwide to relinquish some of their channel space to be able to make that frequencies available for other purposes, mobile broadband, wireless services, 5G services that are coming online. And then we have to repack the remaining broadcast stations into a smaller radio band, a much more efficient one. That's one of our jobs here, is to make sure we use the nation's airwaves as efficiently as possible. So we're repacking broadcast stations nationwide, including a number of stations in the Pittsburgh area, into a smaller radio band.
Mm-hmm. Now, this collection of signals in the mid-range, they're kind of special. In the 60s, they were designated for an education component, or at least they must have an education requirement. Why was that important at the time, and would this move change that?
No, the move doesn't change a thing. All we're doing is reorganizing where stations live in the airwaves. And so that doesn't change any of the programming or purpose of any of the stations. And the auction didn't just apply to the public stations. It applied to all of the commercial stations as well. So we're moving both public and commercial stations.
The Department of Education seems to be concerned about the education component, though. I believe they sent a letter to the FCC, fine with the proposed sale, but in that letter they said, don't cut the component, end that requirement, and suggested setting aside revenue from the auction, the sales, to help students without internet access. Is the FCC open to that?
Yes, but that's a different auction than the one we're talking about or that I've been working on. The one I'm working on is with respect to an auction that we already had, and again, it didn't impact educational stations at all, but basically it's requiring that viewers who watch TV over the air with an antenna rescan their TVs when we make the change so that their TVs can continue to receive the same stations that they're used to seeing over the air.
So let's talk about the TV stations. What do the TV stations have to do? Then we'll talk about the viewers.
Sure. The TV stations, basically, in order to transmit over a different frequency in the airwaves, they need to typically have a new antenna on their tower, and they need new transmitters in their transmitter room to be able to broadcast on new frequencies.
I believe you used the term earlier, incentivized. I assume this costs some money for the TV stations. Are they being helped out with this, or is it just a requirement to do business?
Yes, they're being helped out financially. The stations that we are requiring to change frequencies and incur expenses for antennas and transmitters, we are reimbursing their costs if they're reasonably incurred. Using the proceeds of the auction that we held to sell the spectrum to wireless carriers. So we made enough in the auction to be able to cover our costs in terms of this transition for the remaining broadcasters.
And really, where does this money go in these auctions, in these sales? Does it go to, the FCC coffers? Where does it go?
Well, in the incentive auction that we held with respect to the TV spectrum, some of the money went to TV stations who relinquished their spectrum. Some of it's going to reimburse the stations who remain on the air but are incurring costs to change frequencies. And the remainder, which was about $7.3 billion, went into the U.S. Treasury for deficit reduction.
Mm-hmm. We have about a minute left, Jean. I wanted to ask you, so viewers, how will they be affected? What do they have to do?
If a viewer watches TV over the air with an antenna, either rooftop or indoor, as opposed to cable or satellite dishes, the viewer will need to rescan their TV in order for to be able to continue to receive the channel. That's a fairly simple process using the remote control, and you go to the menu button and set up and do an auto scan or auto search, words to that effect. Each manufacturer is
right.
A little different. And it takes 3 or 4 minutes. But we do have some resources available for viewers who want to learn more about the auction and how to rescan at our website, which is www.fcc.gov/TV rescan. And we have a call center open from 8 a.m. to 1 a.m. Eastern Time, 7 days a week for viewers who need a little extra help. And that's 1-888-CALL-FCC.
And we'll put all that information on our website as well. Jean Cadu is the chair of the Incentive Auction Task Force at the Federal Communications Commission. Jean, thanks so much for taking the time today.
Thank you for helping get the word out, Kevin.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, the Pittsburgh Office of Veterans Affairs has had a rough go the last several years, from bacterial outbreaks to repeated challenges in administration. Can a native son and former Navy Lieutenant Commander help right the ship? We'll have a conversation with incoming director Donald Koenig. Plus, a peek inside Pennsylvania's peatlands, where scientists are studying the unique habitat to monitor for climate change. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance by Julia Zenkovich, Julia Maruka, and Hannah Gaskill. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.